on 98 FM and online. This is Phoenix FM.
Good evening. Welcome to Book Club on Phoenix FM. I'm Utama Prasad. With me tonight, I have, let me see, author, actor, voiceover artist, Ben Crystal.
Hi.
And you've just written your... Is it your first book on your own?
It's my third book, but my first
book on your own, yeah. Shakespeare on Toast, and how's that going?
It's going really well, actually. People are really taking to it. Well, it's never been done before as well, which is good.
See, I wouldn't know, because I have never really paid much attention to Shakespeare stuff at all.
Well, that's okay. You know, not a lot of people have, and those that have this idea that, you know, that they should, or that it's really difficult, and I suppose that's what I'm trying to do with Shakespeare on Toast, is address that sort of difficulty.
And before this, you co-authored a book, well, two books with your dad, David Crystal, which were Shakespeare's Words and Shakespeare Miscellany.
That's it.
Is that right? Okay, cool. Well, welcome to Book Club, Ben.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Hi to all the listeners. And I should say, you've got a listener, I think, out in Estonia. So, hello, Helena.
How do you know that?
Oh, I told her that I was coming on. She's listening live.
Well, hello, Helena. And, well, we're going to be talking about Ben's book, Shakespeare on Toast, and all the books that Ben read as you were growing up, and your favourites and your not-so-favourites as well. Listeners can give us a call, 01277849931, that's 01277849931. Text us on 89892, text the word Phoenix, followed by your message. Text costs 25p, plus your service provider charges, and of course email us on radio@phoenixfm.com. Back after the song by DJ Shadow. Welcome back. This is Book Club on Phoenix FM. This is Matan Prasad, and with me tonight, author, actor, voiceover artist, Ben Crystal. How do you do so many things, honestly? I mean, you're only 31,
you
said.
31.
And, yeah, how have you been able to do all these things to your space time?
When I was in drama school, I was picked as to go to the National Theatre Studio in London to go to a verse speaking workshop, and at the end of it there was a panel with Juliet Stevenson and Mike Maloney and Simon Russell Beale, all the great verse speakers of the sort of their generation, and they basically said, you know, they were asked, how do we get to be where you are? And they were like, well, there's no real secret, and if there was, we wouldn't tell you, but the one thing we can say is, don't sit at home and wait for the phone to ring. And I mean, indeed, you know, before I went to drama school, I went to university and did a fairly straight English language degree because I knew that acting work would be thin on the ground. And then when I left drama school, I was travelling up to help a friend on a production of Much Ado About Nothing. And I was using the book at the time, a book called Onions, is glossary. And it's a very short book, and it was written in 1910. And it's a dictionary of all the difficult words in Shakespeare, but it isn't all the difficult words, because it was written in Victorian times. It was written to an audience that had studied Latin in school. And, you know, my generation, our generation, you know, we don't study Latin anymore. The Victorians didn't like the bawdy words, any references to sex and that kind of thing. So it was lacking a lot. And I phoned my father up, who's a linguist, and said, look, you know, this book just isn't good enough. I need you to help me find out what some of these words mean. And then at the end of the weekend, I was travelling back down to London, and I phoned him up, and I said, you know, someone should really write a new book, a new dictionary. And he said, well, why don't we? You know, he's a linguist, I'm an actor, he's got a very different education to me, and we met in the middle, and then 3 years later, Shakespeare's Words came out.
Wow.
And I was writing it in between acting work, and then I realised, well, I can carry on writing. You know, I love Shakespeare. I used to hate it, but it's just something that I've grown accustomed, grown very good at, mainly from acting it. And so when I'm not acting, I write. When I'm not writing or acting, I do voiceover work. When I'm not doing either of those, I teach. You know, it's keeping the place spinning as quickly as possible.
But it's amazing that you and your father actually got together and did and saw this thing through.
Yeah.
Because it could have just stayed an idea and someone else would have done it.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, with all three books, with the Shakespeare's Words, with the Miscellany, which is like 1001 fun and fascinating facts about Shakespeare, and now with Shakespeare on Toast, it's never been done before. None of them had ever been done before. There was a gap on the shelf, and you just, you know, I've got to fill it if there's a gap on the shelf.
Well, we're going to talk about that a lot more later on, but we're going to talk about your reading first.
Okay.
What was the first book you remember reading?
Now, the Beano doesn't count, does it?
It could, but I mean more like as a young adult.
Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, I was very badly read. when I was in my teens. I'd read a lot of Enid Blyton and that kind of thing when I was sort of 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, I suppose. And then I stopped reading, and I read a lot of Garfield comic books. And
I love
the
Garfield.
I know, I do too. I think Garfield's the reason why I started drinking coffee, very sadly. but which is not a good thing to ascribe to a cat. But and then I remember I was sort of 14 or 15, and my sister was reading The Colour of Magic by Terry Pratchett. Mm-hmm. And I remember starting to read that, and I read every single Terry Pratchett book out there, and then caught up with him and sort of read the new ones when they came out when I was sort of 16 and 17. So I suppose if there's a reason why I'm reading proper books without pictures in, it's Terry's fault.
It's just really annoying, because Terry Pratchett's come up on my show a few times, because
mm-hmm.
people keep talking about him.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things where I really, really want to read him,
mm-hmm.
and I will eventually, but I've got no time. I need more time. I think we all need more time.
Well, yeah.
There's so many books out there.
And there's so many books that, you know, we should read, with capital letters at the beginning of those words, mm-hmm. you know. I mean, people say, oh, you know, you have to read the Bronte sisters. You must read Dickens. You have to read Shakespeare. And with that, you know, especially with Shakespeare as well, there's this idea that because he's a part of our heritage in this country, and indeed across the world now, there's a feeling that we should read these books, and so that there's an awful lot of pressure. Mm. There's not enough time to read all the books in the world, and I think you need to just read the ones that you feel happy with, and never mind what other people say.
The only Shakespeare play I read was because I was made to, was Macbeth in college.
Yeah.
And I don't remember paying any attention at all, because, I mean, we were a big class. We were about 80 of us in one class, and I was always right at the very back with my friends.
Yeah, of course.
So doodling on the pages and writing notes to each other and stuff. And when it came to the exams, we'd get these guidebooks.
Yeah, the York notes.
Yeah. And that's pretty much how I passed my...
That's the way most people experience Shakespeare for the first time. They're made to do it. They're made to read it in mm-hmm. class. And, you know, you look at it on the page and you don't know why you're really being given it. It's got odd words in it. It's got this weird thing called iambic pentameter. What a stupid name that is. And then, you know, I mean, the idea of reading Shakespeare in a classroom is so far away from the way that the plays would have been originally received. It's like someone in 400 years time picking up the engine manual to a Ferrari and trying to appreciate the joys of driving it. You know, it's ridiculous. That's how far away it is. And it just doesn't make sense. And that's what I try and address in the book as well. You know, you picked up the York notes to see you through. And there are so many books out there that, like, this is the Bluffer's Guide to Shakespeare. We'll tell you what every scene means, what every play is all about. But you don't learn anything from that because it's spoon-fed to you. So what I've done with Shakespeare on Toast is basically give the reader a handbook so then they can go to any play or any scene and work it out for themselves.
I've got part of the way through your book. I told you that, didn't
I? Yes, you did.
And I'm going to keep at it.
I bet you it'll make you. I know you said you're not that into theatre earlier, but I bet it'll make you pick up another play. And you know, that's the other thing. Everyone thinks that Macbeth is a really dull, boring piece of literature with a capital L on literature. But actually, like, Macbeth is Al Pacino in Scarface. It's the story of a man who decides he's going to reach the top, does anything he can to get there, and then once he's there, ruins it. It's exactly the same as Scarface.
So I don't know different. What Scarface.
Oh, it's a brilliant movie.
I've heard. I really should. There's many things I need to listen to and watch and read.
You need to leave this booth.
I don't think I'm in here often enough, but yeah. your next question is, what is your favourite book of all time?
Of all time?
Mm-hmm. Or off the moment, if you have one.
Man, that's difficult. I just recently did my top 10 favourite books for the Book Depository. I suppose I should say... which is a great place to buy books, by the way, I should say. I'm plugging them, but I love their website. I should say Shakespeare, The Complete Works of Shakespeare, but that's kind of obvious.
Yeah. Predictable.
Yeah, and predictable. I absolutely adore Haruki Murakami. Mm-hmm. I think he's a great writer. He's really fun, and my first experience of him was Norwegian Wood, which is just a fabulous book. Necromancer by William Gibson is a brilliant piece of cyberpunk fiction that was written in 1984, 15 years before the internet even started. And
what's the book called again, sorry?
Necromancer.
Neuromancer.
Why am I talking necromancer? That's something completely different. All My Friends Are Superheroes.
Andrew Kaufman.
Yeah. Do you know it?
I love it.
If anyone out there who doesn't know it, it's a really, really short book about a guy who falls in love with a superhero. It's a bit similar to that Uma Thurman film that came out a while ago, My Super Ex-Girlfriend or whatever. But it's a really, really lovely book. And it just leaves you with a really stupid grin on your face when you finished it.
Yes, it does.
It's fabulous.
I love Tom. I love Tom. He's the main character in the book, isn't he?
Yeah. And, I've never been big into classics, I have to say. But I recently read Jane Eyre. And it is heartbreaking. It's absolutely heartbreaking. It's wonderful.
I haven't read Jane Eyre.
No, I mean, I'm not a big fan of the classics, but, and equally, I relatively recently read Great Expectations by Dickens. Mm-hmm. And, you see, Dickens is one that my father, you know, I just thought, I'm not going to read this. These books are so blooming long, I don't understand it. You know, I said to my dad, he just talks about London alleyways for 10 pages. What, you know, what a London alleyway is like. You know, what good is that? And he said, yeah, but you'll never read a better described alleyway in London. And I thought, well, that's a good point. Nicely put.
Yeah, very nicely put, actually. Yeah. Your next question, which book have you read most frequently? But before you answer that, do you reread books?
All the books in that top 10 that I wrote. Mm-hmm. And for those of you that are really interested in this, you can go to shakespeareontoast.com, and there's a link there to my top 10 favorite reads. I chose them purely and simply on the understanding that I reread them. I go back to them, just like my favorite films are probably The Shining and Blade Runner, because they're just films that always terrify me when I go back to them, and I just want to watch them over and over and over again. The book that I go back to most is probably Neuromancer, actually.
Okay.
Because, I mean, cyberpunk fiction, it's the sort of style of fiction where the author will use words or phrases that you don't understand in the first instance, and then he sort of explains them a few pages later. But there are still scenes, passages, I suppose, parts of the book that I've read the book 5 or 6 or 7 times, and I still haven't entirely grasped it. Okay. And I love that. I love the fact that there's more to find.
Mm-hmm. And who's this book by? Neuromancer?
William Gibson,
okay. Name one book author you don't really like. You don't particularly.
Man. Thomas Hardy. I studied The Mayor of Casterbridge in school, and I think that really killed it for me. He's a very depressing author, though. There's probably huge Thomas Hardy fans out there that are probably rolling, you know, screaming, what are you talking about? How can you be an author on Shakespeare and not like... Well, you know, I mean, each to his own, I suppose, and perhaps one day I will.
The only book of his that I'm familiar with is Tess of the D'Urbervilles,
right.
And after that, I don't think I want to read him anymore, because I don't think he liked women very much.
I don't think he liked things very much. I mean,
Poor Tess!
I know!
It was terrible.
There's no doubt that he was very, very skilled at what he did. Mm-hmm. I just don't think he's for me. And, you know, that's what, you know, excuse me, I think that's what people have to, you know, think about with Shakespeare. You've got this idea, perhaps, that Shakespeare is dull or boring or difficult and he's not for you, but I think it's because we're not receiving him in the right way. And, you know, before you completely write Shakespeare off, give Shakespeare on Toast to go. I know I'm plugging the book a bit, but...
I
should, because, you know, obviously I want it to sell. Mm-hmm. But the reason why I wrote it was definitely not to make money. I mean, you know, publishing is incredibly hard business to make money, and just like acting, it's... The reason why I wrote Shakespeare on Toast is because I was going around schools and teaching Shakespeare, and I was acting it a lot, and I found just this common problem with people that, you know, that they just had this difficulty with him. And I thought, you know what, that's fair enough if it were true, but Shakespeare's a lot easier than people think it is, and someone needs to show people the way, as it were. The idea that Shakespeare wrote these works of literature is just not true. Shakespeare was giving the Elizabethan audiences their daily soap opera. Mm-hmm. Though people say that Shakespeare would be writing for the soap operas now if he were alive today. It's a cliche, but it's true. He was giving them their daily slice of blood and murder and lust and lies and revenge, and it's just the same as the storylines in EastEnders and Coronation Street.
That's funny, because I think people use Shakespeare lines all the time.
He's everywhere.
And even people who haven't read or watched him, because... my husband and I, before we got married, I think that half of the first night we'd spent sitting in my kitchen chatting away, he left the next morning, and we were going to meet a few hours later at a party. But as he left my flat, he said, "Parting is such sweet sorrow." And I remember thinking, "God, you're so corny."
But it's true. I mean, you know, how many people out there have heard the phrase "as dead as a doornail," or "this something disappearing into thin air," something being fair play, not having slept a wink, someone being a tower of strength, all that glitters is not gold. These are all Shakespeare.
I didn't know they were Shakespeare.
Oh, yeah. He invented over 1,000 words that we still use today.
Something like 1,700 words?
Yeah, he's everywhere.
I got through my book, by the way.
Yeah, you know.
Wait, we should try and stop talking about Shakespeare on Toast right now.
Yeah, no, that's fine.
Because you've got loads
under
film.
We're not going to talk about Shakespeare on Toast anymore.
No more. Or I will hit you.
You can't reach me from there. You can throw something at me.
I could throw something at you, yeah.
That's fine. I've got a fair bit of ammo here as well.
Your next question is, what type of books do you like reading most?
What type?
Mm-hmm. Oh, you don't really have a type?
I do, I suppose. I don't like reading books that are... I like to escape. I suppose it's the same with films. I don't particularly like going to see gritty dramas that sort of explore a very painful life or that kind of thing. I suppose that's part of the reason why I don't like Thomas Hardy. I like reading books to escape, to disappear into a world that's been beautifully created, that has wonderful, full characters that's that's what I'm talking about. Shakespeare now, not Shakespeare on Toast. That's one of the reasons why I like Shakespeare. He creates these wonderful, magical worlds that you can just, you look up and 3 hours have gone by. So I like reading science fiction, not aliens and spaceships, but the kind, in the same way that some of Murakami's work can be science fiction. Richard Brautigan, who's written Sombrero Fallout or the Hawkline Monster, he writes very similarly to the way I write, short chapters, quirky titles, but these incredibly funny and very different worlds. They're fabulous.
I need to get all these names of the authors you're talking about down.
Yeah,
towards the end of the show. Where's your favourite place to read?
Where? If I'm in my parents' place in Holyhead in North Wales, I've got an armchair in my room which is really, really big, and it's just beneath a skylight. I've got an armchair in my flat in London, which is next to a big old plant and next to my hi-fi and again next to a window. If I'm outside, sitting in a park under a tree, I suppose. That sounds a bit cliche. Do I ever do that? No, I don't think I do, actually. I like to think that I go to parks and sit under a tree, but usually if I go to a park, I usually want to get up and go to the toilet after about 5 minutes. So I don't,
It's not very comfortable, though, is it? Because you don't have a pillow behind you, under your head. The tree is tough on your back.
Exactly. I like reading on the train, when I'm traveling around the country, not necessarily on the tube. I like reading where I can go to the bathroom if I want to, I can get a drink if I want to, I can grab something to eat, just have things around me, there's music playing, just so I can concentrate on the book without thinking, oh God, I need to, get a bite to eat or something.
Which character in a book do you think is most like you?
Most like me? Mm-hmm. Oh my goodness. I know the character that I would most like to be like. There's a book called Death and the Penguin, which is in my top 10. And it is by Andrei Kurkov. And it is about a guy who writes obituaries for people who haven't died yet. But then the people who he's writing obituaries for start dying.
That's very interesting.
I know, it's really cool. But the coolest thing is he has a pet penguin called Misha. Misha the Penguin.
Aww.
And is probably one of the sweetest characters you'll ever read. He's just brilliant. He just stands and blinks and keeps asking, sort of silently asking to get fed fish. there's a lot of me in them. I suppose there's a certain, Calvin and Hobbes.
Yes. I love Calvin.
I'm a lot like Hobbes.
Oh, Hobbes is cool.
Yeah, go on, scratch
Hobbes
my belly.
Hobbes is really cool.
I'll start purring.
My favourite ones are the ones
both
where...
both animals, have you noticed. That's
well,
weird,
even
isn't
Calvin.
It? Calvin? Hobbes, Misha.
And Garfield that you've got into, yeah.
Yeah, gosh, I'm all about the animal characters. It's weird. I hadn't noticed that before.
I've got a question for you from Alice in Islington.
Hello, Alice.
She says, what is your favourite Shakespearean word? Use it in a modern sentence.
Use it in a modern sentence? Good question.
If you want to have a think about this, you can answer this later on if you
no,
want.
No. I think, one of the big problems with London is the fact that it is very populous.
What does that mean?
It means many people, I suppose. There's a speech in Richard II, where at the end of the play, I'm not sure if I'm using that word right, so I'll use it in a correct sort of sense, where Richard has realised that he is all alone and he's in prison and he's trying to... He's lonely. And he says, I have been studying how I may compare this prison where I live and to the world. And for because the world is populous, and here is not a creature but myself, I cannot do it. yet I'll hammer it out. My brain, I'll prove the female to my soul the father, and these two beget a generation of still-breeding thoughts, and these same thoughts people this little world, in humours like the people of this world, for no thought is contented.
That's the reason why
it's my favourite word, because it's in this most beautiful, beautiful speech.
So it doesn't thank you, Alice. That's a good question.
Well, I think, you know, there's this idea that, you know, that Shakespeare should be spoken with a very posh accent. Oh, for a muse of fire that would ascend the brightest heaven of invention, a kingdom. You know, the sort of accent of John Gielgud and Laurence Olivier in the 1950s. Shakespeare doesn't have to sound like that. You can, I mean, I can give you an example of what Shakespeare sounded like in Shakespeare's day, if you want. Which would have been sort of more like, oh, for a muse of fire that would ascend the brightest heaven of invention, a kingdom for a stage, princes to act and monarchs to behold the swelling scene. You know, it's a much more grounded, earthy, dirty accent, I suppose. And, you know, you can speak Shakespeare with any accent you want. The point is that there's a, you know, this iambic pentameter. All that is just a guideline, a base rhythm around which Shakespeare works. And through it, he uses it to direct his actors. But as long as you're keeping that rhythm, it doesn't matter how you say it.
It's amazing that you can jump from one accent to the other, because I can only do what I'm doing now, and then my very strong Indian accent when I talk to my mum and my dad,
of course,
or my family back in India, that's it. All I can do is no. What does that sound? Scottish?
It sounds a little bit sort of Indian, a little bit South Welsh, but then a lot of people who try and do South Welsh slip into sort of, you know,
and
an Indian sort
apparently of when I say what rubbish, I sound Welsh.
Go on then.
What rubbish.
Oh yeah, you do.
I do.
I'm from North Wales, you know, so, you know, when I go home, I start talking a bit like that, like, and it's very different from the South Wales, which is a bit more sing-songy, you know, it's a bit...
How do you do that? I really wish I could do accents, I really do.
I don't know, my love, I just do it, it just comes out, it comes out, that's not the right accent, I don't know where that...
Is that Bristolian accent?
Yeah, sort of Somerset, yeah, sort of way, yeah. I don't know, it's funny, in the last sort of 10 years or so, there's been more and more people getting into the acting profession, so if someone wants someone with a Yorkshire accent, then they'll hire someone with a Yorkshire accent.
Yeah.
So you don't get called on much, but... I mean, the last play I did, I did a play by Simon Stevens last month called 1 Minute, and I was playing a guy from Stockport.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I had to do a Stockport accent then, but I don't know, it's something I've always been
able to do. How does Stockport accent sound like?
Oh God, you've put me on the spot. Oh, it's a bit sort of, it's not quite Lancashire, because it's got a bit of sort of Manchester in it, so it's a, oh God, it's sort of a bit like that.
Can you do Sheffield?
Sheffield's difficult. What's Sheffield? Go on, give me
one. I don't know. I just told you I can't do accents.
So I could do anything, and you go, oh yeah, that sounds like Sheffield.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, I lived there for a year and a half, but I don't know.
Well, then you must be an expert. So
no,
I can do anything.
Because Sheffield is full of students, foreign students, and students from the rest of England.
Yeah.
I don't think I actually ever heard any local Sheffield accent to know it was local Sheffield.
Well, I mean, that's the thing about the accent I just did then, you know, the sort of old for a muse of fire that would ascend the brightest heaven of invention, you know, that Shakespeare original pronunciation, the accent that would have been around London in Elizabethan times. And people hear all sorts of things from that when I say it. They hear Warwickshire, they hear Irish, they hear American, they hear Cockney, they hear Australian. And of course, all those accents, London was all those accents. And then people left and colonised America and colonised Australia. And that's why those accents are the way they are. You trace them back and they all come from here, with mixtures of Dutch and all of the other colonies.
It's so cool, isn't it? I mean, I've never really paid any attention to this whole accents thing, but now that I've heard you do different accents in like 5 minutes, it's pretty cool.
It's fun. It is fun, but and it should be, you know, the thing about received pronunciation is the idea that it is the accent of clarity and that kind of thing, and all other accents should be quashed and all other languages, you know, that's rubbish. You express your identity through accent. Accent is an incredibly important aspect of one's personality, and I love them. I love them all.
Yeah.
I think probably Edinburgh is my favourite though.
I love even Glaswegian accents. Oh,
I know.
They're so difficult to understand, but then they're amazing.
You know,
and the Irish.
You phone up most call centres, and nine times out of ten, they'll be Scottish. For some reason, we in this country find the Scottish accent very pleasing to the ear.
It is.
It is.
It is.
I know.
Can you do Irish?
Yeah, I can. I'm going to feel a little uncomfortable now because I once, when I was very drunk, managed to go from Belfast down to Dublin, through to Galway and down to Cork, all the way down.
It sounds like a good story.
If I start talking in an Irish accent, I'll start talking a bit like that, it's a bit sort of... you're going to get a lot of complaints from any Irish speakers out there saying he doesn't sound a feckin' thing like Irish, but... it's harder to tune into those. Don't ask me to do Geordie. I had to learn Geordie once, and it's really difficult.
Geordie is what?
The sort of way I can't do it. It's by Google.
There's Geordie from Newcastle?
No, I can't do it.
Okay. Excellent. Now, we've gone so far from our topic.
There's a topic? Oh, right, yeah, the topic. Books. Hello.
Books. And your next question is, which literary character would you most like to have a significant relationship with?
A significant relationship?
It could be a romantic one or a male character you'd like to be really good friends with.
There's no reason why I couldn't be a romantic one with a male character,
absolutely,
I suppose.
Absolutely.
Literary. I'm going to have to think about that. Can you put some music on whilst I think about that?
I'll just go to the next question. You can think during our next song break.
All right, I'm going to think about that, okay, and I'll come back to you.
Okay. What's your fondest memory of reading?
My fondest memory of reading?
Was it drinking cups of coffee reading Garfield comics?
Yeah,
books?
No. My fondest memory of reading is probably... This is going to sound a bit twee, actually, but it's true. Every single time I pick up a book... The reason why I'll buy a book is because I enjoyed the first line, mm-hmm, usually. If a book starts with the first line, I'm sold. Or if it's got a really nice cover, I'm a sucker for good covers.
Mm-hmm.
It just looks different, I don't know. My favourite moment from reading is when I realise that I'm going to love this book and I don't want it to end. When I read the Dark Materials trilogy by Philip Pullman, mm-hmm, they're just fabulous. I sobbed so hard at the end of the third one of that. But I remember particularly two moments, I think at the beginning of chapter 14, it's called The Silver Guillotine. And just from that title, I was so scared because I knew what it meant.
Yeah.
I put the book down. And then I had to pick it up again because I was so keen to read. And then later on, when the two polar bears fight, I was so gripped by the fight. Again, I had to put it down because I wanted to make it last. And I've just finished... what have I just finished? I've just finished Neil Gaiman's Neverwhere. I hadn't read that before. And it's that moment when you realise that you're going to completely fall in love with this book and you don't want to go anywhere else without it and you just don't want it to end. You want to keep on reading it for, as long as you can. That is my favourite moment.
Yeah. Oh, it is. It's the best moment.
Yeah.
Do you have any literary guilty secrets?
Literary guilty secrets? You mean sort of things, books that I'm not particularly proud of?
Yeah,
the fact
having
that I
read or own.
No, I mean, I suppose when I was younger, there were things that I was less keen to tell people about. I mean, for example, I'm a bassist. I play the bass and the double bass. And I learnt to play the bass by listening to Sting,
mm-hmm,
who isn't cool at all. And we're not talking about the Police here, we're talking about Sting's solo career.
Yes.
He's not cool at all, but he is a brilliant bassist, mm-hmm, and was a great person to learn the bass lines from. Also learned how to play the bass too. So that's a pretty guilty secret, I suppose, music-wise. I don't think I have any. I'm so happy with myself in my own sort of world.
No,
I don't care what other people think.
Speaking of Sting, I have to say, last year, sort of around this sort of time, I had, on different shows, the actor and the writer, mm-hmm, of this play called Sting for Nolte. And the play was about the main character, who's a philosophy professor, mm-hmm, who hates Sting so much that he decides the only way that he would like Sting and the only way to save his relationship with his fiance would be if Sting were to remake all of Nick Nolte's films. Not just films, stage, Broadway, everything.
Okay.
And it was hilarious. I don't think they're doing any more shows, actually, because they did a whole years of touring and stuff, and I think they've all had enough now. But it was an amazing play, very, very funny, and they did really well. But yes, let's move on.
Okay. Oh, I did think, it's not a guilty secret, but the one thing I do is I'm a sort of book whore.
Mm-hmm.
So if I like an author, I'll read pretty much everything they've ever done. Yeah, I just devour them.
Yeah.
And that's not really a guilty secret, but it is kind of slightly obsessive.
I think it's probably a good thing to be, because sometimes some authors have one really good book, and then you sort of assume that all their books are going to be great.
Yeah.
But you don't get on reading them.
No.
But you sort of assume that they're all great. And you sort of recommend them to everybody else, and they read shit books of these authors, and then they go, what are you on about?
Well, I mean, Andrew Kirchhoff, who wrote Death and the Penguin with Misha, Death and the Penguin is a brilliant book. The two or three books after that he's written, I didn't like so much. Murakami, you know, I think he is a genius, but he can get really weird.
Yeah. And read Kafka on the Shore.
Oh, I tried to. I didn't manage to finish it.
I managed it, but it was very, very difficult, very hard going.
His last one, After Dark, is a really, I think it's called After Dark, is a really short book, and it's set over the course of one night. And it's just brilliant. It's staggeringly written. It's really wonderful. Girl can't stop, can't wake up, and disappears into a TV at one point. I love how esoteric he can get, but there's some books of his I just can't read. Kafka on the Shore is one of them.
Dance, Dance, Dance.
No, I haven't read that.
That's amazing.
Is it really good?
Yeah, it's really, really good. That's what got me into Murakami.
What about Sputnik Sweetheart?
I haven't read that.
Brilliant.
I read Norwegian Wood, Kafka on the Shore, The Wind Up Bird Chronicles. Yep. It's a bizarre book.
It's a very bizarre book.
And Wild Sheep Chase.
Yep.
I said, yeah, I've read that one. I think that's about it that I've read of Murakami.
What's your favourite book? That's what I was going to say.
Of Murakami's?
No, overall. I put you on the spot.
It's difficult to think of one favorite book when
it is. Yeah, I think it's like I say. I think it's as hard as choosing one favorite film or one favorite anything, because in the choosing of it, you omit so many others. And
And you sort of pick one, and then you think something else, and then there's no stopping anywhere, really. So there's no point to think about it. So your next question is: what do you think is the most overrated book of all time?
The most overrated book of all time. In this country, well, generally, probably Shakespeare.
You think Shakespeare's overrated?
Absolutely, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
But you've just written a book to make Shakespeare more accessible.
Yeah, but that's part of the problem. You know, because Shakespeare is so highly thought of, so highly regarded, so highly revered, we put him up on a pedestal, and we are made to respect and revere him. And that's because people rate him so highly. He is brilliant, but some of the plays aren't. You know, Shakespeare isn't famous. He's not brilliant because of the stories he told.
Mm-hmm.
Hamlet, which is brilliant, it's a brilliant play, has plot holes in it the size of buses. Love's Labour's Lost is not a well-written play. Timon of Athens is a really tricky play to perform.
But then that could be because of what you said in your book about how plays got lost because he didn't want people publishing it. So people would copy or memorise the lines of a play being played out and then print it.
Absolutely, and steal it. That's true, but the complete works that we have is... the reason why we have Shakespeare's plays is because two of his actors that he worked with for 20 years edited his plays into a complete edition called The First Folio, which was published in 1623. And that was 7 years after his death. Now, Shakespeare wasn't interested in having his plays printed because he wanted people to see them. Yeah. 80% of Elizabethans couldn't read, so it was kind of pointless to read them. Mm-hmm. If they hadn't have printed them, we would have lost them. But, I mean, no, so it's more the idea that Shakespeare is brilliant generally. Everything about him is great. Mm-hmm. And that just, I mean, it struck the fear of God into me when I was younger. So, don't get me wrong, I think he's wonderful. But the how high we rate him is a problem. It's more of a problem than a help. It's a hindrance, if you will.
Okay. Well, that's pretty fair, I think.
Oh, I think so,
yeah. What do you think is the most underrated book of all time?
Underrated? Mm-hmm. Shakespeare. Don't roll your eyes at me.
You're not supposed to say that.
You know? Am I not?
Cause, yeah, because it's raining. People can't see me rolling my eyes at you.
Oh, right. I thought you meant I'm not supposed to say Shakespeare. Again, you know, I know this sounds like I'm just sort of, you know, some weird sort of Shakespeare freak, and I suppose in some respects I am, otherwise I wouldn't have spent 2 years writing this book. But again, you know, there's people don't, because of all these problems around him, this literature idea, the idea that he's full of oldie words, and he's not, only 5% of the words in Shakespeare are difficult.
Mm-hmm.
and this idea that iambic pentameter is a problem. And in actual fact, you know, once you know how it works, iambic pentameter is, you know, the metrical style of poetry that Shakespeare wrote in. It's the easiest amount of words to say in one lungful, so it's for performing. And he wrote his stage directions into it, so once you know what those are, what the clues are that he left to perform it, finding those clues and reading his plays is like a treasure hunt. It's like a Da Vinci Code treasure map, you know? But because of all these problems and people not finding an easy way to work through them, they think he's not worth it. So he's in a horrible position, being 400 years old. No one really knows how to work their way into it. But they expect, when they read him or when they see him, that we don't have to do any work. Well, in 400 years' time, would people get the cultural references in Friends? Probably not. We'd have to do a little bit of work at it. It's like I say about the car engine manual. So he's at the same time massively overrated and massively underrated.
You make it sound really good, actually.
Well, thank you. I'm pleased.
I really ought to go watch a play.
Yeah.
Would you recommend be the first play that somebody who has had no interest in Shakespeare before and has never read or wanted to read any Shakespeare before?
I would say, rather than pick a particular play, because there are 39 of them altogether, and each deal with so different things, you know, what it's like to be in love with someone that you can't be with, what it's like to be so jealous of someone and so in love with them that you kill them, what it's like to be in love with your best friend's girlfriend, all of these wonderful explorations of what it is to be human. The human heart is really, and in the heart speaking, the mind speaking through the heart, I suppose, which is brand new to the Elizabethans. It's still relatively new to us, and that's why we still study him. But so I can't really pick a particular play, I suppose, because each one will resonate differently with different people. What I would say is that if you want to go and see Shakespeare, go to London, go to the Shakespeare's Globe on Midsummer's Night. The Shakespeare's Globe have a season of about 4 Shakespeare plays every summer. They play for 6 months, and 3 nights of the year, at midnight, they put on a show. Stand in that theatre, that exact recreation of an Elizabethan theatre, okay, it's a flashing light for some reason. There's no roof, and it's usually a really warm, still night. There might be a breeze flowing through. Everybody's been for a drink. They come to the theatre at midnight and they watch a play. And you can hear the Thames sometimes lapping. And it is just the most magical experience. It is the perfect introduction to Shakespeare. It doesn't matter what the play is. And you will come out of there at 3 in the morning buzzing, I promise you. And you can go and stand there for a fiver. I'm sounding like I'm selling the Globe now, but I've acted there. And it really is where Shakespeare makes most sense.
It's amazing.
It sounds amazing.
Wow.
It's just electric. And, I've been to midnight performances and active midnight performances there for, I don't know, the last 6 or 7 years, and it hasn't rained once. It's always a lovely night. I don't know why.
Wow.
Luck, I suppose. Happenstance.
It's a magic space, Shakespeare.
It is a magic space.
Right, on that note, we're going to go for a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk more Shakespeare.
Whoop, whoop.
Coming up is Koshin, I think, if I can see the song. But yeah, the number to call is 012-778-49931. That's 012-778-49931. Text us on 89892. Text the word Phoenix, followed by a message. Text cost 25p plus your service provider charges. And of course, email us on radio@phoenixfm.com. Just like Alice did from Islington. Thank you, Alice. That was Koshin with Face in the Crowd, or Face in a Crowd. This is Book Club on Phoenix FM. I'm Matan Prasad. With me tonight, Ben Crystal. Ben, I've got a question for you from one of our listeners, Gaz in Cambridge, who says, have you ever tried reading Garfield and ignoring what Garfield says? His comments are always in thought bubbles, so not actually spoken. Garfield is just a cartoon about a lonely man talking to his cat. If you could set a Shakespearean scene using the characters from Garfield, what would it be and how would it play out?
Nice. Very nice question, guys. There's a website, if anyone's online, to Google. I think it's called Garfield Without Garfield. And what they've done is they've taken the comic strip and removed Garfield and his thought bubbles from it. So it's just John talking to himself.
Right.
And it's a step further than what you're saying, guys. And it's really, really funny, but very, very sad and scary. So what's the thing?
If you could set a Shakespearean scene using the characters from Garfield, what would it be and how would it play out?
Well, Hamlet is always talking to himself, and he sometimes thinks he can see the ghost of his dead father. So I think it would be quite cool to see John as Hamlet and Garfield as Claudius. King Hamlet. That'd be quite cool, I suppose. It's probably been done somewhere. I'm sure Garfield as Shakespeare is out there somewhere. I'd be surprised if it wasn't.
See, I wouldn't know, because I'm not into Shakespeare, but I will be into Shakespeare after I finish your book.
So I want to say hello to Tara and Prasad.
Mum and Dad.
Mum and Dad listening out there in Bangalore.
And they're watching me on webcam as well. Hi, Mum. Hi, Bob. Right, okay.
You're blushing. Bless you. I'm not supposed to say this.
I had a feeling you were going to say this on air, because you when you asked my parents' names. But, you know.
What was that question I missed?
The question was, what literary character would you most like to have a significant relationship with?
Okay. I would love to have a significant relationship with Misha the Penguin. I would very much like to have a drunken conversation with Marvin the Paranoid Android out of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. I think that would be rather cool. There's also in, I think it's Restaurant at the End of the Universe, one of the Hitchhiker's Guide books, there is a lift, an elevator, who he sort of has vertigo. An elevator that has vertigo. He speaks. It's a speaking lift. It's not really vertigo. It's existential dread. So someone steps in and wants to go to the top floor, and he sort of he says, "Wouldn't you like to consider the possibilities the down has to offer? The basement's rather nice." That kind of thing. I think that's quite cool. Goodness, it's a really good question, though. I think probably if I couldn't have any of those, then... Oh, I know what it would be. You read The Dark Materials?
No.
Philip Pullman? Every character in this slightly different world has their own daemon, D-A-E-M-O-N, and they're kind of like an animal personification of part of your personality. They're part of you.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what my daemon would be. It would probably be a cat of some sort. But I would very much like to be able to see and interact with my daemon.
I think mine would be a monkey.
I'm not surprised.
Why?
No comment. No, I don't know why, but you said that. I can just see a little monkey perching on your shoulder there and just sort of, like, you know, feeding you jelly babies every now and again or something.
I don't like jelly babies. Well, I like nutties.
You can feed it jelly babies. You like what?
Nutties.
What are nutties?
They're Indian chocolates, which you don't get here, which we used to eat a lot of when we were kids.
Tara needs to send some over to you.
Well, you know what? She is going to.
She is now.
Yeah, she is now. But no, I've got a friend who's gone down there yesterday, and he's going to bring me.
What are they like?
I don't know what's inside them. They're a bit like Maltesers. They look like Maltesers.
So they're hard inside.
But they taste nicer than Maltesers do.
Okay.
Maybe it's just the taste of India.
Yeah.
That could be it. The but taste Nutties, of home. Mm-hmm. Nutties are amazing. They really are.
Okay.
But, let's... let's go back to your book.
Okay.
We've got 10 minutes left. Talk about Shakespeare on Toast.
Oh, goodness, time flies.
I know, it does, when you're having fun. Are you having fun?
Absolutely. Yeah, I thought we were, like, half past. No, I don't want to go. That's not fair.
Well, I don't think Cliff would be very happy for me to cover his show as well. So
no, that's... It depends. What's his show? Oh, it doesn't matter. No, I mean, he plays
music, really, really funky music.
Really?
For Friday night, yeah.
All right, I'll wrap some Shakespeare over the top of it. See what happens. Go on, what were you going to say?
Talk about your book, Shakespeare on Toast. All you want, and I will not throw anything at you.
Really?
Yeah.
It's a promise?
Promise.
Okay, it's really good.
I was going to throw my phone at you just then.
Really? I would have caught it. I don't know. When I wrote it, I went out and looked at a lot of the other books out there. There was a book called Amoa Massa Mat and all that, which is a book by Harry Mount, for anyone that's always wanted to learn Latin. A lot of people out there probably have heard of Lynn Truss's Eats, Shoots and Leaves. These sort of Christmas gift books that try to sort of get you into something that you might think you're not sort of, you don't want to get into. So I read a lot of these before I started writing Shakespeare on Toast, and a lot of them get it wrong. Because they go too far, too fast, too quickly. The Latin book starts declining verbs, sort of telling you, you know, the I version, the you version, the we version, whatever, after like six pages. I really don't do that with Shakespeare on Toast. It's split into five acts instead of chapters, so it's much like a Shakespeare play. And I talk about, the first thing I talk about is Arnold Schwarzenegger. because because Arnold Schwarzenegger's career is almost entirely because of Shakespeare. I talk about EastEnders and Coronation Street and Friends and Days of Our Lives. I quote Mos Def and Akala, Miss Dynamite's brother who won the Mobo Award
in 2006. Doc Cotton.
And Doc Cotton. And it really is a sort of... Shakespeare is as difficult as any of those things. And so I draw on everything I possibly can to sort of to help people through.
And how are you finding... have you had any feedback from people that have... Because you've been doing events at schools and stuff, haven't you? Talking to students and trying to get them into...
And literature festivals. Yeah. It was great, actually. I was in a school up near Chester the other day, and I didn't realise I was doing this. I thought I was speaking to some Year 10s, some 15-year-olds studying GCSEs, and I was actually speaking to Year 7s, 100 of them. They're all 11 years old. And I was like, oh, my God, what am I going to do? And I phoned my dad up, and I said, geez, what am I going to... I've never taught 11-year-olds before. And he said, yeah, but think about it. They haven't studied Shakespeare yet. You could be their first experience of Shakespeare. You could get them excited about it before they start hating it. And that was just, you know, a gift, really. I've been doing a lot of literature festivals, too, around the country. There's a whole list of them on the ShakespeareOnToast.com website, by the way, if anyone wants to see where I'm going to be. It's been quite humbling, actually. You know, you spend so long on a book writing it. And there's a lot of blood, sweat, and tears, and very, very late nights and early mornings. And there's a wonderful quote by Oscar Wilde. He says, "I worked all day on a poem. In the morning, I added a comma, and in the afternoon, I took it out again." I really was very, very, very careful with trying to get the tone right, I suppose, and trying to make it accessible without dumbing it down. It's a lot harder than it sounds. And the wonderful thing is the feedback has been unanimous. You know, people have said, I wish I'd have had this when I was in school. I wish I'd have brought my son, daughter, brother, whatever, along to hear you speak. I'm going to get this book for them for, you know, Christmas. They have to read this. They have to... which is just... You know, I'm really glad. I'm really glad it works because, you know, like I said earlier, the whole point of writing it was to stop people being, you know, worrying about Shakespeare or thinking it just wasn't for them and saying, look, give him a chance. And you know, I promise you, this will be your way in.
It's amazing. I think it's very well done.
Thank you.
And
the cover helps as well. I mean, it's a really fun cover.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's
called Shakespeare on Toast, and the designers have, you can see the picture online, have got a sort of plate with Shakespeare on a piece of toast, with a knife and fork next to it. Actually, it's not a knife and fork; it's a quill and fork, and a jam jar on the back with Shakespeare on it. They've done a really, it's a really,
yeah,
friendly.
They did really well. And what are your plans for the future? Do you have anything else you're working on at the moment, or you?
Yeah, well, I've just finished acting a play. I'm now running around the country talking about Shakespeare. I'm probably going to produce another play in the late winter, early spring, and around March time, around Easter time. I don't know what acting is going to be out there. Sort of acting comes when it comes. I've got a few more ideas on some Shakespeare. I think I want to write some fiction at some point. Just carry on keeping those plates spinning, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, I look forward to reading your fiction.
Oh, thank
because
you.
Because I'm more of a fiction kind of gal.
Yeah?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And that's all we have time for tonight, Ben.
It's been a real pleasure talking to you.
Oh, good. Well, it's been really good fun talking to you, too.
Oh, great.
And you having called me Lazy Cow, and what else did you call me?
I can't remember what else I called you. I was going to throw something at you, but...
throw something at me. Well, your microphone.
You were going to throw something at me.
Well, that's because you kept talking about Shakespeare to me when you weren't supposed to, and I told you can't talk about it.
She's a very strict interviewer, if you can listen up there.
Yes, I'm a bully, but a nice bully.
But a very nice bully.
A very nice bully, yes. Thank you. Right, that's all we have time for now. So, Ben, again, thank you very much
for coming
on Book Club on Phoenix FM. And next week, I am back with Giles Long. Coming up next is Cliff Black. Have a good weekend, guys, and I'll see you next week.